Arts class is going to tell us about that.
This is a very rough diagram.
You want to tell us the difference between adsorption and absorption? You probably looked it up, didn't you?
Pardon?
Did you look that up?
No.
At the atomic level, they're about the same, but one of them means a physical process, like a sponge absorbing water, and adsorption means a chemical process where something is loosely bound chemically.
Dr. Hall, maybe we better have this on Monday.
Sure.
Yeah, I think we should. I can tell you what happens to the ammonia in the system, but I think there's a lot more detail that would be interesting.
Okay. You don't have stage fright now, you're up there.
So? No, I don't.
Did you draw it?
Yes, I drew it. I think it'd be more interesting if we had it one day.
Okay.
You can come up with some anecdotes.
Okay.
What's your major, Grace? Mechanical drawing?
No, my major is history.
Pretty good mechanical drawer.
Look at the pins.
Oh, just you don't need to put the pins. Drawers are particles. Actually, I just put it up so we'd all be curious.
Make sure we come.
No, we can't wait.
One of those teaching gimmicks. I've been carrying around these periodic charts for a long time. Somebody want them? Practice up and all that sort of thing. By the way, does anybody know it?
That's all.
Can you do all the representative elements, the two columns of alkali and alkaline earth elements, and then the ones over there?
The gases. The gases and then the other non-metals.
Can you fill in the transition elements?
Yeah, that's part of your problem.
Man, gotta get with it. The course is half over. Let's see, Marilyn Allred, Craig Alford, and Mike Ard, Isabel Baum. She's the one who sometimes comes and sometimes doesn't. She's not officially registered. Clayton Christensen. Clayton not here today. Martha, come. She has the flu. Ray DePue, there he is. Peggy Fisher, where's Peggy? There you are. Charlene Hall's not here, is she? There you are. Oh yeah, you moved over one seat. Cindy Lindsay, and Dan Peterson, Diane Robinson. No Diane today. David Smith. Suzanne Stauffer and Grace Stewart and Dale Swan.
Paul
Swan. I circled all the names by who wanted to be called by what, but I missed yours. Jeff Taylor, Kimberly Van Fleet, Grant Walker. Where's Grant? And Kevin Williams.
Okay. Quite a few absent today. I've escaped the flu bug so far this year. Do a lot of students have it?
I think it's mostly.
Now that we know so much about thermodynamics, let's learn a little more.
As I told you, there are literally billions of thermodynamic formulae that can proceed from the two equations I wrote on the board. One of them being a statement of the law of conservation of energy, and the other one being a statement that there is entropy created in spontaneous processes, which sometimes a chemist calls an irreversible process. Well, starting from that, chemists, mechanical engineers, and physicists have invented certain concepts that go along with it. Now, what you do in science, you have these beautiful fundamental laws, which you express in simple mathematics, if you can. And then, just like a guy writing an opera or a symphony, you take that theme and then you embellish it. And you know, there's not much difference between anything you study in school when you start looking at what happens. Music's related to science, believe it or not, all over the place, even things like history or English. They all sort of play the same tune. Well, now, in embellishing these kind of concepts, in science, you have to keep it practical because the ultimate test of science is in some experiment. Your theories are only as good as the experiments say they are. And that may be one place where, well, I don't know, even there, I guess you get the final test in music. I was going to say it may differ from music, but I don't know how many composers who are dead also have dead works, but maybe there are a lot of them. Maybe it's the practical ones that have survived. And I sure hope some of them eventually die. They've been current for about the past 6 or 7 years. My machinist comes in the shop and he turns the... I'm just gone. And he turns the radio to some station. And I come back and I turn it to KLUB. And he said, "You're just like my dad." You guys never listened to KLUB. You didn't get that, huh?
Yeah, I think that song.
I think he has it on he has it on Kobo or something like that. Loud to full volume. Well, maybe it's a key. Here are some of the formulas, and some of these are invented in a sense. We have that energy is equal to heat absorbed minus work done. That's a statement of the first law, where the work is the form of energy that goes out. Now that makes sense. You see, you put energy into something and you get some work out, then you have to subtract this to tell the energy that remains. This capital E is sometimes called the internal energy. Now, in chemistry, the work done is usually done as pressure-volume work. Pressure times volume has the same terms as does energy. I mentioned that we can measure energy in calories, we can then measure it in electron volts, we can measure it in watts, we can measure it in foot-pounds. There are, you can go to a handbook of energy conversion tables, and you can have a whole flock of different ways in which energy can be measured. Got a comment?
Watts is power. You got to have a time on it.
Got to have the time on it. All right. Watt hours. Is that better? Watt hours. Now, a pressure times a volume has the appropriate units of energy. So if I take a pressure, some fixed pressure, and I change the volume from V
the initial to the final. Then the change in volume, which a mathematician would simply write as delta V for macroscopic quantities, or dV for infinitesimal quantities, would be a measure of change in a volume. So I could write the internal energy of a system undergoing some change, in this case doing some work, is equal to the heat absorbed by the system minus P dV. Now from the perfect gas law, which we discussed, PV equals MRT, and if I differentiate this thing calculus-wise and keep the pressure constant, I could say P dV equals MRVP. And I can make this substitution for perfect gas and say that E is equal to Q minus NRVP. And a lot of other things you can do with that kind of equation. Now there is another function that is called enthalpy. This E is called the internal energy of the system. Internal energy. You pick a block of water or a block of steel or whatever your system is that you focus your attention on. That's the internal energy of it. Now there's a function H that's called enthalpy. That's a strange word, enthalpy. But it's defined as, and when you use three lines instead of an equal sign, you mean it's a definition. Defined as E plus PV. This is one of the very useful terms used by chemists. When I went to school, they called H the heat content. So you may, if you were searching older literature, hear this called the heat content. But modern day papers will call that function the enthalpy. This is an equation that is useful when you work at constant pressure. If you carry out chemical reactions out in the room at 1 atmosphere pressure, this is a useful equation to use, and a chemist will seek off the delta H of a chemical reaction as being the heat of the reaction. If I have hydrogen plus oxygen giving me water, there will be a certain amount of heat given off, and I will say that is the delta H of formation of water. And you'll see lots of tables of delta H. I start with the elements, and I form 1 mole of water, and there's a certain heat given off, and I can measure that at constant pressure, and I call that the delta H, the heat of formation of water. And you can do that for no end of substances. And there are tables and tables of heats of formation, which are useful in calculating a lot of things about chemical reactions other than just the heat. I saw a hand go up. Came down?
Wouldn't you normally put a plus in there to say that this and that is?
Well, the sign of something is an arbitrary matter. And unfortunately, chemists, if heat is given off, they say that the delta H is negative. It's arbitrary whether you say it's positive or negative. Chemist, if the value has a negative number, if I say delta H equals minus, and I don't know what it is for that, it's probably 100,000 calories, that means heat was given off. If the sign were plus, it would mean that heat had to be taken up by the reactants to form the product. Well, so arbitrarily, if it's negative, heat is given off.
What I had in mind was you don't need an operator in between those to indicate that they're both reactants, just a conjunction there in the case that they're both products.
Since you do not know the absolute heat content or enthalpy of the elements, you arbitrarily take it to be zero.
I mean, just as far as writing down your product side goes, you just You just take juxtaposition to mean that this and this both the results. I mean, you put a plus sign on the left to indicate that both of those are going into it.
Yeah, but these react together. Yeah.
But on the right side, you just put them together, just write them one after the other. Is that the way things are going to go?
Well, sometimes there's more than one product. Do you want to include the heat in the reaction? Is that what you're saying? I can write, and chemists sometimes do, hydrogen plus a half a mole of oxygen yields one mole of H2O plus some heat. And if this is the correct number, I will leave a positive sign here if I'm writing it like that. But if I say the enthalpy of formation, or the heat of formation of water, and I'm speaking of one mole, I usually put a little zero up there to indicate that just one mean one mole. If that happens to be 100,000 calories, put a negative sign in front of it. But if I write it, the heat as part of the equation, which you can do, then it has a positive sign. Maybe we aren't getting together at all.
I don't think so. All I'm asking is, do you generally just write the products one after the other, or do you generally put some kind of indicator that they're all products and not starting some other unit here?
If they're on the right, like this water is a product.
Yeah, but you've got the H2O juxtaposed with the delta HF.
This is just a statement by me. That's not part of the equation.
Oh.
So. Now, you do not have to measure the energy evolved in every equation to get it for others. There's a law of Hess. And if I know the heats of formation of lots of things, say the heat, I'll have to invent one because I don't have any numbers with me. My numbers will be wrong. I'll just be illustrating the principle. Let's say that in forming ammonia, H2 plus nitrogen yields H3N and H3. And let's say that heat is absorbed in that process. I don't know that it is. Let's say there are 50,000 calories absorbed. I would write the delta H for the formation of one mole of nitrogen, and I need to balance this. I'm going to need 1.5 moles of this and 0.5 mole of this to make 1 mole of ammonia. I say delta H is equal to a plus 50,000. This is why, as I told you before, to the chemist, the hardest thing there is trying to decide whether the sign is plus or minus. Because it's an arbitrary thing, and you set standard rules. The national organization says, if heat is given off, we're going to call it negative. But if you write it in the equation, as though things are happening, you say hydrogen plus oxygen yields water plus some heat. And in this case, minus some heat. And you can treat these like algebraic equations to find other reactions and how much heat would be involved. For example, let's multiply this thing by, let's multiply this entire equation through by 2/3. What I want to do is get rid of this. I want to cancel out my hydrogens and have a reaction between nitrogen and oxygen if I can. Oh, this equation doesn't have enough stuff in it to do it. Let's see. No, it doesn't. I need to bring some examples. It's like a jigsaw puzzle. It takes you a while to figure them out. But what I'm saying is, if you know the heat of formation from the elements of a lot of things, it's possible to add and subtract these things just like they were algebraic equations and find the heats of formation of compounds from other compounds. So one need not measure every darn thing there is in the universe in the way of heat effects when chemical reactions take place. You can measure several thousand, and from those several thousand, you can calculate the heats of millions of reactions by a law that is known as the law of Hess. Well, I don't want to
I don't really care too much if you remember the details of some of these things. I'm just trying to give you a brush with thermodynamics. All right, there is another thing that is used by chemists, and it's called the Gibbs free energy, given by the symbol G. Gibbs free energy is defined as this thing, which is H, minus TS. Now, S is the symbol for entropy, and T is the symbol for temperature. Okay?
We're just trying to figure out whether that was Gibbs or Gibbs or Gibbs.
Gibbs, G-I-B-B-S. J. Willard Gibbs, famous scientist of yesteryear. All right, now there are a lot of other equations that can be associated with these things. But this thing right here is the important thing to a chemist. This is the important equation. The Gibbs free energy of a reaction. Now we work with changes in going from reactants to products. So if the change, and use the symbol delta to indicate a change, in the free energy in going from reactants to products, if delta G is negative, you have thermodynamic permission for the reaction to take place. I think I already wrote on the board one day that there are two things that a chemist needs to consider when he is considering a chemical reaction. Number one, he needs to consider the thermodynamic problem. The thermodynamic problem he addresses himself to is the question, is delta G for the reaction negative? You can find that out for a great many reactions if that it's near ordinary pressure. Temperature can vary a lot, but it needs to be near ordinary pressure. And if you're an organic chemist at DuPont, you'll certainly be associated with a thermodynamicist who can just go to thermodynamic tables and calculate an answer to this question. Is delta G negative? Now, if it's so, the reaction that is written can proceed. As far as the energetics of the reaction is concerned, it can proceed. Now, you see this term contains an entropy. The enthalpy minus the temperature times the entropy that's involved. Now the second thing he addresses himself to is the kinetics of the reaction. And that's a much more difficult problem. Now let's draw the picture we had the other day of the chemical reaction. I just said energy when I drew the arrow this way the other day, but it's a specific kind of energy. It involves enthalpy and entropy. You see, if the entropy is a great big negative number, T, of course, has to be a positive number. There is no such thing as a negative temperature. The heat can be a positive thing. But if the entropy is a great big number, you see, we can have a negative G. So entropy can be a driving force for a chemical reaction. Now, if the entropy is positive and the H is minus, then you can have minus. So there are three situations. These things can be equal, in which case you would have a teeter-totter situation. The chemical equation that you write is exactly balanced on a teeter-totter at an equilibrium. If the entropy is real large and is negative, now a negative entropy means that you've built something like a crystal, you've built something with order in it, then this number would be positive, and in order for the chemical reaction to go, this would have to be a negative number. If this were negative and this were positive, then both of these quantities would be tending to make the reaction go.
Now, for a chemical reaction, you can change the entropy and you can change the enthalpy by changing the temperature and changing the pressure. But sometimes the temperature required is too high or too low, and the pressure required may be beyond reach. Well, what this is now is the change in the Gibbs free energy. It's a specific energy that the chemist takes a look at, and he has to calculate it from that equation, which involves entropy and the enthalpy. And this is a thing we'll call a reaction coordinate. It's something to do, it can be very complex, with the way the reaction proceeds. It represents the reaction taking place. We have this little valley with an average energy, and we have another valley over here. Let's consider the graphite diamond reaction. Now, this is a simple reaction in a sense because it's just carbon in the form of graphite yields carbon in the form of diamond. There is no change in the chemical composition at all. So chemically, it's a very simple chemical reaction. You just change the crystal structure, it's the same thing. Now it's possible to measure the enthalpy change in going from carbon to graphite or graphite to diamond. It would be the same either way. It would be just of opposite sign. Now, before man learned to make diamond, he could not start with carbon and measure the heat effects of going to diamond. But he could take diamond and he could burn it. Or he could heat it and transform it into graphite, and he could measure, and using Hess laws by adding up various equations, in which carbon is reacting with hydrogen or oxygen, he can come out and find out what the delta H change is for going from diamond to graphite. And then he changes the sign on it, and it'll be, just be the opposite sign. So man knows the difference in enthalpy between these two things. Now he also knows the difference in entropy, because he can determine that by cooling diamond and graphite to as near absolute zero as he can get, and then measure the heat capacity as he warms them up. I need to introduce you to the third law of thermodynamics at this point. The subject's pretty sticky, but it's all to come. Third law of thermodynamics is not often mentioned, but it has to do with entropy, so it's in a sense related to the second law. Third law says that the entropy of a crystal, I gave you a lecture on crystals, didn't I, in the order that we have in crystals, didn't I bring in the slide projector? Okay, if you have a crystal at absolute zero, the entropy is equal to zero. See, entropy is complete order. There will be no entropy in heaven because heaven will be a place of absolute order. And I don't know. That's just highly philosophical speculation I just made. But anyway, isn't there something that? What is the statement about order in heaven? What is that? Oh, it's the Lord's house is a house of order or something like that.
Every kingdom has a law given. But if it's in a continual burning, it's got to be increasing its entropy continually.
Yeah, that's the problem. I don't know whether celestial beings are nuclear powered or not. If they're nuclear powered, it'll be pretty hot, probably.
Still be increasing.
Well, I guess there are some revelations that sort of infer that it is a fiery thing, light and fire. you can't behold God with your own eyes, which you couldn't do if he's some kind of a nuclear motivated device. I suspect it's a lot more sophisticated than that. I mean, you try to extrapolate from what man knows.
Well, I was just wondering if the universe is pointing down.
Yeah, that's what Rex Coates is going to be talking about. That's, you know, not with a bang, but with a whimper. That's the way everything's going to end.
Yeah, but is that...
I don't think it's really that way. I mean, we make a big extrapolation, but that's...
I was just wondering, you know, it started out as this ball and it's just expanding, going to a level of greater randomness until it occupies the finite space that our universe is supposed to have.
Gravitational.
Yeah, isn't going to come back like two particles?
Oh, some guys think there's an oscillatory universe. I don't know. They're hard questions. Anyway, as you heat things up, entropy always increases. You take any substance, steel, iron, water, gas, whatever it is. If you warm it, entropy increases. See, everything is in motion. Vibrating, rotating, oscillating, all kinds of atomic motions. And they become more violent as temperature gets hotter and hotter. Now, they're not all moving at the same speed. I may have made the statement that oxygen molecules in this room are traveling at 4,000 miles per hour. That's the average one. There are trillions and trillions of them. And at any instant, one of them might be standing absolutely still, and another one might be going a million miles an hour. But if you average the speed of all of these trillions of oxygen molecules, they are going about 4,000 miles an hour. Now, if you cool the oxygen molecules down, they'll turn into a liquid. Now, in a liquid, they're not free to roam like they are in a gas. A gas is expanded about 1,600 times over a liquid. Lots of room to move around. So there's a lot more entropy. Now you get down to the liquid, they're next to each other, and they can rotate around, and they can sort of vibrate, and they can move past other molecules, but they're touching each other now. And so there's a lot less entropy. Now when you go to the solid, they're not free to move around past each other. They're sitting there in fixed positions, and they're just vibrating. That's all they're doing. So when you take a solid and you cool it down to a lower and lower temperature, these vibrations get slower and slower. And when you get to absolute zero, it almost stops. There's still what they call 1/2 h nu energy of vibration at the absolute zero, a ground state beyond which you can't get. So even at absolute zero, there is some motion, but the entropy can be said to be zero. So the third law is simply a statement that the absolute entropy of a solid, perfectly crystallized substance at absolute zero is zero. Now, man can get down pretty close to absolute zero in his cryogenic temperature experiments, and so he'll take a solid substance, this crystalline, and he'll heat it up and measure a thing we call a specific heat. Specific heat is the amount of heat energy that a substance can hold. Specific heat is a common thermodynamic thing. Well, by the symbol C, if you measure the specific heat at constant pressure, like 1 atmosphere of air pressure, you put a subscript P. If you measure the constant volume, that is, you make some changes, but you always keep the volume the same, then the specific heat is at constant volume. Now, actually, specific heat is some function of tension. A mathematician would put it that way. And it's also a function of pressure. And in theory, it might be a function of the strength of magnetic fields and a lot of other things. But for most practical purposes, you only need to know specific heat, and this is the most useful one, at constant pressure as a function just of temperature. 1 cubic centimeter of water, which is a little cube about like that,
has arbitrarily been assigned to have a specific heat of 1 calorie per gram per degree centigrade. What that means is if I take this thing at, and I think they use 4 degrees centigrade as the reference temperature, and raise it to 5 degrees centigrade, 1 little gram of water, they say it absorbs 1 calorie of heat. Then you compare all other substances to the water. You do this a lot in science. You make an arbitrary standard because you don't know the absolute value of anything as a rule. This entropy is an exception. There's good theoretical reason to believe that the entropy is zero when you're at absolute zero. But in most of science, we work with relative values, differences between things and some arbitrary reference. We use water to establish the value of a calorie. And then you compare copper to water and gold and everything else to water. You increase the temperature of copper by 1 degree, and it absorbs a lot more heat than water. I don't know how many times more, but I guess maybe 10 times as much heat as water. And that's called specific heat. Now, if you measure the specific heat as a function of temperature from absolute zero on up to other temperatures, you can determine the absolute value of the entropy of crystalline solids. And guys do that. The integral, for you who know calculus, is Cp dT. Well, that's not right. That's delta H. Let's see. You have to take Cp dT divided by T and integrate that over a temperature range. And that is the entropy.
Brother Williams.
How is entropy measured and what is the unit of measurement?
Calories. All thermodynamic quantities are measured in calories. That's the same measure as enthalpy or free energy. This and this and this product and that and the G, all measured in calories.
The same calorie that the calories in food measured the same way. Kilocalories, there's often confusion.
Kcal is 1,000 small calories.
And I think in the food book they just use the word cal, but they mean large calories or thousands of calories. So when you eat your avocado and it's
200, 400, they're high, aren't they?
1,000 calories per avocado, whatever it is. It's obtained by burning the avocado. And the value they give you is a delta H. It's an enthalpy value.
Let's see. Now back to this story here. While we could not do the graphite to the diamond reaction, we could do the reverse, and we could calculate entropies, and we could calculate H's, and we could calculate free energies from the delta H's and the S's and the temperature change. So if we take an average value here, here's carbon graphite, and here's carbon diamond. It isn't that way. Diamond has the higher free energy. It's this one. This distance in here at absolute zero temperature is about 400 small calories, only a tiny difference. And this has been the frustrating thing to scientists. See, in order for the energy to be negative, this is a positive free energy. This has to be a lower level. It has to be down here below this level. Diamond and graphite only differ in energy by 400 stinking little calories. And chemists make changes every day involving hundreds of thousands of calories by changing the reacting ingredients or just changing the temperature and whatnot. And here you are,
only 400 calories apart in energy, and yet man tried for 175 years before he could turn one into the other. Simple little chemical business.
You can turn diamond into graphite.
Yeah, and that's how you find out all the numbers. So you find out the numbers by turning diamond into graphite. And then for the reverse reaction, you just change the sign. For the actual reaction, which was carbon-diamond going that way, you'd say this is minus 400 calories. But for the reverse way, graphite going to diamond, then it becomes a plus 400 calories. You just change the sign if you change the direction of the experiment. So see, you could measure the thermodynamic data and learn what you had to do. And what you learned you had to do, and this was, this, all these calculations were first made by Jessup and Rossini, two chemists at the National Bureau of Standards in about 1932. Now there were some uncertainties in the calculations because the experiments weren't too good. But these guys figured in 1932 that if you had 20,000 atmospheres of pressure at absolute 0 degrees, Kelvin degrees, that you could shift this picture I have drawn so that you move this down exactly 400 calories, right to there. Now, whoops, I need to draw this like that. So that the average energy value, the free energy, Gibbs free energy, is exactly the same. Now you have the teeter-totter, you see, and you can't have equilibrium. What you like to do is actually make this go down lower, so there's a lot of driving force, and get the energy difference here to be minus 10,000 calories or something. But if you could get it just even, then there would be a chance that you could turn the graphite into diamond. So the answer to the first question came in 1932. Is delta G negative, and how can you make it negative? Well, the answer was delta G is not negative. It's positive, some 400 calories. But the thermochemical calculations show that if you put the graphite under pressure, then 20,000 atmospheres would bring it down just even. Now, before the thermodynamic calculations were possible, geologists had assumed that it took high pressure to make diamond from the examination of the pipe mines in South Africa. There's another reason that you might think of it. The density of graphite is 2.25 grams per cubic centimeter. The density of diamond is around 3.51 grams per cubic centimeter. See, it's more dense. Well, pressure tends to make things dense, so you would just assume, without the thermodynamics, that it must take some pressure to do this. But who knows how much? 10 million atmospheres, only 10 atmospheres, or what? Well, Jessup and Rossini gave the first answer, about 20,000 atmospheres. Now let's talk about the second part of the problem, the kinetics. Chemical experience tells you that you have to heat things up, particularly solid substances, to get reactions to go fast. Sure, 20,000 atmospheres on a piece of graphite at absolute zero Kelvin favors, from the thermodynamic point of view, the reaction to proceed at least part way to diamond. But it doesn't tell you whether it's going to take 100 billion years or just a few minutes. You would guess it wouldn't take a few minutes from your chemical experience. So you'd want to heat it up. Well, this part is cut, but I have been trained in this field by Henry Eyring, so I tackled this part of the problem. Now, what I learned was the following.
Well, on your back track, talk about the thermodynamics a little more. If you put temperature on the system graphite diamond, this is raised. Now see, your chemical instinct says increase the pressure, increase the temperature to increase the reaction rate. But increasing the temperature makes the thermodynamics worse and worse by making this an uphill thing. So as you increase the temperature, you've got to increase the pressure to bring this back down again. Now by around 1951, it was estimated, and it was a pretty good estimate, that if you went to 1,000 degrees Kelvin, which is about 700 degrees centigrade, a pretty bright red heat, then you'd need 35,000 atmospheres of pressure. So the first goal of the General Electric Company in building a pressure machine was to find something that could withstand 35,000 atmospheres of pressure at 1,000 degrees Kelvin. Now in doing the kinetic studies, that really made things horrible, because here's what happened. All right, you increase temperature, it helps your kinetics, it hurts your thermal. You improve your thermal by increasing the pressure to bring this down, but increasing the pressure hurts the kinetics. Now let me see if I can make a summary of that. It's just like somebody, like a monkey chasing his tail around in a circle. We'll just make a little paper first. Let's think of the thermal, and we'll say what pressure does, and we'll say what temperature does. All right, pressure helps. Temperature hurts. Speak about the kinetics. Pressure hurts. Temperature helps. Well, I wrote an article on this. It was in a fairly obscure thing. It was put out by Stanford University.